All right, that's a clip that's been around for a while, but it's a wonderful video, isn't it? I mean, I don't know. I think you'd have to check your pulse to see if, you know, you're still with us, if that doesn't move you to some degree or not. It's from a couple of years ago, of course, a returning soldier, and there's something wonderful about that. But I grabbed a frame from that video where the little girl's expression, you see it all over her face there, when she first catches sight of her dad. What would you describe this as? What would you describe this expression as? Shock, surprise, disbelief, a certain level of disbelief in that whole expression there. It's wonderful to me, you know, you can pretty much read in her face everything that's trying to be processed in that moment. It's a beautiful little picture there. Dad, he's in Iraq. How could he possibly be here? What's going on here? So it eventually melts into tears of joy and relief. But initially, as we're looking at her, as we see this, we see this confusion. We see this shock. And honestly, when you're looking at it, can you feel it? Can you actually feel it yourself right now as you relate to her? There's something about the human condition that's presented there. It captures so much of the hope and the love and even the surprise that's associated with that. We're going to be looking at a captured moment like that in our study in the Gospel of Luke today. So I want you to keep in mind this expression. Keep in mind the feeling behind that. We're going to be looking at a moment where something so unexpected happens that's encountered, and all the shock and confusion and surprise that leads up to a joy that is experienced by the characters in our narrative and even experienced by us still today. If you've got a Bible or a Bible app, if you will navigate to Luke chapter 24 for me, please. We're down to our last three teachings in the Gospel of Luke. When we left our story last time, Jesus had been executed by crucifixion. And after he died, a man named Joseph of Arimathea had asked for his body and took his body and put it in his own tomb to give him a respectable burial. And we looked at Joseph's actions and what we could learn from those about what it means to actually identify with Jesus in a world that's kind of hostile towards Jesus in a lot of ways. When the chapter ended, it was the Sabbath, and it talked about the women were preparing all the spices for his body. Remember, bodies were put into tombs where they'd be wrapped up with spices so that they would then decay, and then later on people would go in, gather up the bones, put them in a little stone box, a little ossuary, and collect them within that tomb. So tombs had multiple uses at that time. So they were preparing to do that, but the Sabbath was on them, and no work was supposed to be done in the Sabbath. So when we left off last time, if you could imagine it like a movie, the scene fades to black at that moment, and now, as we begin reading chapter 24 and we get to verse 1, imagine that the scene now fades back in as we get to verse 1. It says, "But on the first day of the week, at early dawn, they went to the tomb, taking the spices they had prepared. And they found that the stone rolled away from the tomb. But when they went in, they didn't find the body of the Lord Jesus." Okay, we'll find out that of all of the Gospels, Luke actually gives us the most varied details of any of them, of all four of them, especially in these events that occurred after Jesus' death and burial. Remember, Luke is making a documentary, so he's going to try to get everything from every angle that he can, gather up all the different perspectives that he possibly can. Saturday was the Sabbath, but when Sunday arrived, as soon as they safely could, as soon as it was light enough for them to move around, at the crack of dawn, these women go into action. They're going to go in there and take care of this. They wanted to provide this respectable burial for the person that they had followed for so long, the person that they admired and cared about. They believed Jesus deserved this. So they were going to put these spices and oil on his remains to quell the stench of decomposition. It wouldn't have been a very pleasant task that they were about to undertake, especially putting that delay in there like that. But they respected him, obviously. They cared about him enough. This was something they were willing to do. They were willing to take care of this. But when they get to the tomb, the large stone that covered the entrance, remember, it's made for multiple uses, so they had to have some device. This guy was rich, so clearly his tomb was built in such a way that it could have access, or a large stone had been rolled out of the way. And now all of a sudden it's out of place. So they run inside to see if Jesus' corpse has been disturbed or worse, defiled in some sort of way. And in a really bizarre twist for them, there is no corpse. They get inside there and there's no one home. There's no one there. Now the other gospel accounts give a lot of varying and on the surface contradictory details about all of these events that take place here. And for some, that's been a reason to dismiss this story, to dismiss the veracity of this story, saying, well, you know, none of these things line up. The stories don't match up. To me, that's what makes it all the more believable when I look at this. If these guys had made this story up much after the fact, like the accusation goes, then they would have gotten their story straight when they put it together, wouldn't they? I mean, they would have made sure that all these things line up really well. First of all, they wouldn't have had women as the first witnesses to this whole thing, because in that time, in that culture, women were not reliable witnesses, as we're going to see later on in this story. If this had been made up later, the male disciples would have been the first to discover it and would have right away believed, so they could set the example for everybody who's going to follow after them and follow this new religion of theirs. But the gospel accounts are a complete disarray of bewildered and confused reports. It's just like I think it would be if it were true. Oh, there was an angel there. No, there were two angels there. There was just Mary was by herself. No, there was a couple other people with her. All of these different reports. I remember back in January, I think it was, that we had a little vacation, so we were able, had the luxury of being able to watch the news as it was unfolding, but this cruise ship, remember, and off of Italy went down, and so we happened to be watching it just as this was coming in, the reports were just coming in, and I was surprised at that moment. Here we are in an age of information, an age when we've got technology at our fingertips to get every story straight. We had all kinds of crazy details coming out. Oh, the captain was gone, but he came back. No, the captain's gone and was arrested. Nobody was hurt. Everybody got safely. No, there was actually casualties. And all these different reports that were conflicting and varying, because that's just the way it happens. They call it the fog of war. But it's just things are confusing in the aftermath of events like this that catch us by surprise. So if all of these reports over a cruise ship in an age of information like we have were conflicting, we can see how it would happen there. And you know, the thing is that even though all the details were conflicting about that cruise ship, one fact remained: that cruise ship sank. Doesn't matter how varied the various reports were, the cruise ship went down. That's the reality of this situation. The confusion of this report in the Gospels actually comforts me. That is not the kind of stuff that you'd make up if you're trying to sell a new religion. You'd come up with something a lot more concrete and solid than people walking around going, "What is going on?" Which is what would happen. The women come to attend to a corpse, and that was something traditional. That was something that was very expected. And while it was a very unpleasant task, it was a manageable task. It was something that they could attend to within the scope of their power. But they're confronted with an empty tomb, something that they were not expecting at all. And that empty tomb carries with it a lot of very important messages. It declares a message about Jesus himself and about God's plan at work in this world, even to this day. The women expected to find Jesus right where they left him, everything in the proper order as they had determined it, in a safe, controlled environment where they knew exactly how to handle him. But they didn't find him there. Jesus was not confined to that expected structure. And I believe that the empty tomb tells us that God's plan is not confined, but is presently active in us and in this world. Now, this is obviously first and foremost true of Jesus. That vacant grave is making a strong declaration that Jesus is not just some good teacher in the past that we can admire from a distance and be inspired by as someone long ago. We learn that Jesus isn't just a historical figure that we can tuck safely away in a tomb somewhere and enshrine him and honor him in some way. That empty tomb is sending us this disturbing message that Jesus is the living Christ and he is running wild in this earth beyond our control, beyond our ability to control. Well, believe me, we'd love to keep him in control. We'd love to do that. We've been trying for 2,000 years. We'd like him confined to history, confined to the past, where he can't mess up our plans right here in the present. But he's not there in the past. He's active in the present world, and he's active in our contemporary lives. And there's really not much we can do about that. We're never going to be able to tame him. Jesus is the embodiment. And think of this. Jesus is the embodiment of God's plan through the ages. For all of the world and for each of us individually, Jesus is representative of this thing, this amazing thing God is doing in a broken world. And in Jesus, we see acted out the unexpected ways in which God's plan unfolds. God's not confined to our expectations. He is active in ways that we never even dreamed of, that we never even thought of it, that didn't occur to us. We like to imagine that we can control God's plan, or we can somehow superimpose our plans over God's plan and somehow sanctify them that way and keep everything in our grip. And we'll pray, and basically what we do is we outline for God exactly what it is that we want him to do. We'll say, God, so-and-so needs this to happen in their lives, so please make this happen, and this happen, and this happen, and it will result in this. And I hope you're taking notes, because it took me a long time to figure this thing out. And you know that old adage, you know how to make God laugh? Tell him your plans. Exactly. That's, you know, it's kind of like God is like, okay, sure, if this entertains you to make these plans, you go right ahead. But I'm not doing it this way. I'm not confined to that. What I'm going to do is going to stun you. You're going to be amazed. You're never going to get over how I reveal my grace in this broken world. God's plan is not confined not only to our expectations, but God's plan is not confined to our circumstances. He is active in ways that we never could imagine. You know, I've read a lot of stories about soldiers over the years, especially during World War II, and I've read multiple accounts of specific turning event battles that took place, decisive battles. And I've read so many different soldiers' experiences during those things. Some were engaged in intense firefights. Others were sitting in foxholes, just kind of waiting things out. Others were actually far away from it. You could hear the noise of battle, but they were actually playing cards at the moment. But for all of them, it just seemed like a normal day in wartime. The different kinds of things, moments of horror, moments of boredom, all of it just kind of confused together. But later they would find out that they were all participating in this decisive battle, even though it didn't feel significant at the time, because they couldn't see the bigger picture of how all of these various events were actually tied together into something profound, something that was changing the tides of everything that was going on. God isn't confined by our immediate circumstances, and we so often try to define what's happening based on what it is that we're able to see in the immediate circumstances. But God's active in ways we can't see, and his plan is unfolding in profound ways in our lives. And the empty tomb that those women found is a reminder of that. There's a message coming to us from that empty tomb. God's plan is at work. It's not confined by what you see and what you feel. Well, the narrative goes on here, verse 4. While they were perplexed about this, behold, two men stood by them in dazzling apparel. And as they were frightened and bowed their faces to the ground, the men said to them, "Why do you seek the living among the dead? He's not here, but is risen. Remember how he told you while he was still in Galilee that the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified and on the third day rise." And they remembered his words. And returning from the tomb, they told all these things to the 11 and to all the rest. Now it was Mary Magdalene and Johanna and Mary the mother of James and the other women with them who told these things to the apostles. These words seemed to them an idle tale, and they didn't believe them. Okay, in this pressing confusion that's developing in the wake of this discovery of this empty tomb, the ladies are trying to figure out what happens. They're looking around, they're puzzled. I mean, you have to put yourself in their position for this moment. Think of the little girl in the opening video, looking around, stunned and shocked, trying to piece this thing together, and then suddenly something even more profound and supernatural breaks in on their world. Two angelic figures appear to them to help them arrive at the proper conclusion. They tell the woman they shouldn't be looking for the living among the dead, which of course, you know, that's a sermon in itself, has been preached many times. And the reason that they wouldn't find Jesus' corpse is because Jesus was no longer a corpse. Jesus was no longer dead. That's an incredible statement. That is a statement that should kind of roll around in our minds for a few minutes because it is absolutely insane. Jesus is no longer dead. Okay. And then they remind the ladies that Jesus had fairly plainly predicted this is going to happen. He did this with them three times in Luke's gospel, very plainly, when he was still traveling around in Galilee. He said, look, I'm going to be handed over to the Gentiles. I'm going to suffer, but I am going to rise again on the third day. And you can almost hear the gears in their heads just starting to slowly, you know, move, you know, creak, and thinking, wait a minute, he did say this stuff. Yeah, that's supposed to be literal. We're supposed to take that stuff literally. We're really going to be, you know, experiencing something like that. That's crazy to me. Now, it's interesting to me that they didn't see Jesus anywhere. In fact, all four gospel accounts are like this. Yeah, four gospel accounts. Me and numbers, man, I'm such a mess. All four gospel accounts are like this when it comes to the resurrection itself. Nobody actually sees Jesus rise from the dead. In each case, they're actually given this story to be told. And that's an interesting thing to me. They actually, at this point, didn't see Jesus anywhere in the place. They were looking around for a corpse. They didn't find the corpse. They didn't find Jesus. They didn't find nothing but these two glowy dudes. And all they get is a message, a word that says to them that Jesus is alive. Jesus has risen, even though they didn't see him anywhere. So they run back, they tell the guys, and the guys, like guys so often do, you know, don't have anything to do with this story. The women's is getting hysterical. They're full of grief and they can't figure things out. Because this is a story, and let's give a little credit to these guys. This is a story that flies in the face of everything that we know as being true in terms of how things work in this world. They probably even asked the women, did you see Jesus? I mean, he said he's alive. Did you see him? Well, no, some fluorescent guys said, you know, he's alive. Okay, right, you know, right, sure. But this is a very fundamental message that we get from that empty tomb, something that we have to grapple with right off the bat, something that we've got to realize first and foremost, front and center. The empty tomb tells us that embracing God's plan is going to require faith. This part of the account brings this whole event uncomfortably close to us, because this is exactly what we have. We have a word of resurrection. If I were going to make this whole thing up, if I were going to create some sort of religion like this after the fact of Jesus, something that I was going to put together, I would write this differently to resolve some of these difficulties here. I would have made sure that the women got to the tomb in time to actually watch Jesus rise and be able to see him step out into the sunrise in a whole new day. And then I would work it out so that somehow, on an annual basis, everybody can show up and see him. He can appear again in some sort of dazzling light show and effects and stuff. Some display of glory so that we could absolutely rest assured this is true, because I've made the pilgrimage. I went out and saw him. He shows up every year like the groundhog looking for his shadow or something. Because without all of that, without something like that, all we've got is a message that says he's not here, he's risen. And I'm telling you, it takes faith to believe in a message like that from an empty tomb. Because the logical response to this message is incredulity, which the disciples fittingly provide for them. But you're talking nonsense. That's crazy. Normal run-of-the-mill experience teaches us that death always wins. We learn those lessons early on when the pet hamster dies and we don't tell anybody about it, hoping maybe he'll recover somehow. But after a while, the smell gives the whole thing away. And we realize that we learned these irrefutable facts that death wins. It always wins. There's no turning that around. So when a contradictory claim collides with what we already know as established, we're going to fall right back and cling to that clearly proven fact. We're going to affirm what we know is true about the way the world works. To believe otherwise requires faith, and faith means exchange. That's what faith is, an exchange. See, when we talk about somebody having a lack of faith or unbelief, we don't want to suppose that that means a person doesn't believe anything at all. That's certainly not what it means. When a person doesn't believe like these claims, it doesn't mean they don't believe anything at all. A person says, I don't believe it. It just means that they believe something else more strongly. The women who went to the tomb that morning, they had all the spices ready for the corpse. They had a set of beliefs already. When they took the spices and the oils, they weren't taking those to the tomb and saying, well, we'll bring these along just in case, but let's hope he's alive again. No, that never even entered their minds. That wasn't on it because they already had their set beliefs. They knew exactly how this worked. He was going to be right where they had left him. So when they took those things along, they weren't doing so just out of the chance hope that maybe something had changed. They didn't expect anything to change. They already had their beliefs. But when they encounter something totally unexpected, and the message that they hear is a complete contradiction to what they had already understood about life and death, and it required on their part an exchange. The message of the empty tomb proposed the embrace of a different truth from what was already established in our understanding about things. And God's plan in our lives requires that same kind of radical exchange of beliefs. That's what faith is all about. We can look at all the things that happen in life and run through our little mental database of where all of these things go and what conclusions they lead us to, what it's going to mean to us or about us or the people in our lives. But we're challenged to exchange our established truth and embrace the truth that God has a plan, no matter what it is that we're seeing here, and that His plan is good because He is good. And even though we may have seen our hopes and our dreams get buried and the things that we hoped in fall wildly short of what we expected or what we planned for, the message of the empty tomb invites us to have faith that God did not die when our dreams did. And that He's at work ready to meet us in ways that we never dreamed of before. That's the message behind the empty tomb. And as we look at this, finishing it up here, we get to verse 12. It says, but Peter rose and ran to the tomb, stooping and looking in. He saw the linen cloths by themselves, and he went home marveling, that is, amazed at what had happened, amazed at these events. Now, if I came in here this morning and I told everybody, listen, I got some news for you. Fish are no longer swimming anywhere anymore. They're all walking on land. What would you think? Would you believe it? And what would you say? What? You're crazy. Yeah. What were you smoking this morning, Rob? What's going on? That would be your normal response. Would anybody here think, you know what? I'm just going to jump up and run out there and see if I can find a fish walking around. Anybody willing to do that at that kind of a, yeah, one person, but. But we already know you, Malcolm. In fact, he's heading for the door now. No, but anyway, that's the whole thing. See, that's an odd thing. Nobody here is going to run out and do something like that based on a crazy claim like that. You know, when the women come and tell the disciples that Jesus is no longer dead, they dismiss it as idle tales, it says in the text. In the Greek, it's just basically nonsense. That's what that means. They're babbling nonsense. That's the idea. You know, fish don't swim anymore. Yeah, nonsense. Jesus isn't dead anymore. Nonsense. That's nonsense. That's the reasonable reaction to that sort of news. And yet the message of the empty tomb starts its subversive work of challenging our certainties. Experience teaches us that death wins and even the strongest on the earth succumb to it. Experience teaches us that life is short, so we just got to get whatever we can out of it and make the most of it because it's going to be over soon, so live it up and party hard. And the empty tomb says, really? Can you be so sure about what you're so sure about? The message of the empty tomb is that death is real enough, but apparently it's not final. And that challenges our certainties. The fact that Peter rose and ran, is what it says, tells me that something was happening with him. The story that the ladies told was nonsense. It's like saying fish don't swim anymore. But setting out to sea for himself shows that Peter's certainties were already starting to shift just a little bit. And to me, this reveals one of the most important messages that we get from the empty tomb. One of those things that we've got to come back to again and again. The empty tomb tells us that following God's plan means making way for possibilities. The claim is so outrageous that Peter had to go and take a gander at this situation for himself. The idea that their beloved rabbi had not been conquered by death is so preposterous that it could cause a person to stop and wonder whether maybe or not, if just maybe, it's true. This step of Peter's here is important. This idea that he rose and ran is an important part of this story, an important step in his becoming whole. The Christian faith, it's not a system of information. It's not a theoretic ideology that everyone gets on board that was laid out long ago that we just sit around and defend. The Christian faith takes its first step with Peter right here in a willingness to accept the possibility that what we thought for sure was so certain could actually be overthrown in some way. We thought that death was the last word on everything, but what if it's not? What if there's something else going on here? When we gather like this, like we do here on Sundays or on Wednesdays, to read these scriptures, we're actually following in the footsteps of Peter. We've heard this rumor that Jesus is still alive, and we gather to hear it again for ourselves, again and again, to get this reinforced. We hear this message of the empty tomb that tells us that death is real, but it's not final. That Jesus isn't merely the past, but he's actually the present at work in our own reality, at work unfolding his plan with all of its possibilities in our own present circumstances and life. We experience things in the process of this while we're here that actually sets us beside ourselves. We suddenly realize that I actually think I did meet Jesus here. And then all of a sudden, we're like Peter, wondering what this means to our lives, wondering what this is all about, wondering what this is leading towards and what's unfolding here for us. The text ends with Peter's amazement, but the story goes on, as we know it goes on. It stretches all the way from that experience to this present day right now. And God continues to challenge the certainty of death and ruin with this promise, this unwavering promise of life and redemption that continues to come back just like the tides roll in every day. We can't stop it. That little girl, Hannah Estrig was her name, the little girl in that opening video, she was so surprised to see her dad suddenly appear in that classroom. She started that day like any other day. She started that day expecting to go in and learn the next bits of math, the stuff I missed in school. Expecting to just be there doing the normal things that she would have done with her friends while her father was away, where she knew for sure that he was. She hadn't expected him, but when she saw him, even though she was surprised, she didn't dismiss him. Like, that's impossible. Yeah, he can't be here. My dad's in Iraq. Can't be him. No possible way. No, instead what she did was she threw her arms wide open to the possibilities of what it was that was unfolding before her very eyes. The message of the tomb is that no matter what we understand or what we see from our own view, we need to remember that God's plan is active and it's full of possibilities. We need to listen to the message of the empty tomb. When you're perplexed, when things haven't gone according to your plans, according to the way that you wanted them to go, when everybody's expectations are set for failure, the empty tomb is calling out to it. So the empty tomb actually is like a mouth calling out from the earth. That sure promise that God is not done with this world. God is not done with us. His plan is still underway, and he's got a good ending in store. We just have to believe it. We've just got to exchange what we've always assumed was right for this new truth that's revealed in unexpected way. So let's trust him with these events and all of those things that we experience in our own lives and the challenges that we face. Let's trust him. Let's listen to that message. And let's set our expectations in a different way that includes all the possibilities that God may have in store. Right on? All right, very cool. Why don't you stand with me, please? Father, I just pray for each of us right now. I just ask you to reinforce this truth in our lives. It's an amazing thing, Lord, that you would do this, that you would come through in such unconventional ways. And Lord, it's something that you know us as human beings, we have a tendency to let these things just become commonplace to us. Every year around this time, we talk about this, we talk about Jesus rising from the dead. But sometimes, Lord, I think we fail to see the significance of that in our present lives and in what's going on. And so I'm praying this morning that you begin that process of opening our eyes and opening our ears to be able to recognize and see that you're still at work. Help us, Lord, shake loose from the certainties that this broken planet has ingrained us in. Help us to shake loose from those things and catch sight, just a glimpse of the possibilities that are resident in you as we trust you. Help each of us to do that, Lord. Every heart that resonates with, Lord, I pray that you just come alongside right now and that you surround us with your grace and enable us to embrace this and to live our lives according to this. I pray that for each person that's here this morning, Father. Help us in this, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen.